Taking a look now at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife, Larry Mehler here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, and he's also the associate chair of the newly merged Department of Forestry and Wildlife Ecology. And the reason why I mentioned him being a wildlife ambassador, and John mentioned it as well, is because he was honored with the 2007 Chancellor's Career Award from UW Extension and UW Colleges. So, congratulations on that award.
Well, thank you, Larry. But these career awards kind of make a person nervous. It's great to get them, but yeah, that sort of means, well, the career must be just about over. So
here's your hat. What's your hurry?
I'm not sure whether this is a kind of an underlying message that maybe it's time to move on. But anyway, it's great to be recognized like that.
It sure is, and you deserve it too. I'll tell you that. We have a lot of things to talk about. Deer season opens up a week from Saturday, November 17th. That's the traditional opener. I mean, there have been some seasons already going.
The archery season's been underway for quite some time, and from my archery hunting colleagues, I hear the deer have really been on the move the last week or so, which means some nice bucks have been taken. But it also has some relevance to those of us who don't necessarily archery hunt, but if our recreation is driving to and from some location, then all of a sudden deer movement becomes a big issue with deer-vehicle collisions. So we need to talk about that as well. And, of course, there's been hunting going on for some time now in the chronic wasting disease management areas by landowners, and then there were special seasons back in October. But I think a lot of people are kind of hanging out hoping to restore some of the traditions of opening day, and it still is the true opening day for most of the state. So that comes up a week from Saturday, and it's a big deal for a lot of people.
You mentioned accidents, and Scott in New Glarus, I believe, has something relating to that. Scott, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. With all the talk of deer-vehicle collisions, I guess I thought it would be a good opportunity to mention a device that I have invented and have been marketing in the Madison and Wisconsin area to help drivers who are interested in avoiding collisions. It gives them a great edge. It's an electronic device that pulses the horn of a vehicle on and off at 7 times per second for as long as the horn button is held in the on position. And that modification of the horn, when sounded in the vicinity of deer, whether they're in the road or running towards the road or on the side of the road, it for some reason it creates an almost instantaneous flight response. And it for people who are, like I say, actively engaged in avoiding collisions, this Rapid Honk unit, which I call it rapidhonk.com, it's a very effective device. I've been using it for years in my vehicles. And
Well, what do you think, Scott?
Well, anything that provides people with a little bit of an edge is certainly worthwhile. You know, over the years, quite a long time ago, we were embroiled in all sorts of testing and contentiousness over some of the various ultrasonic whistles and other things that were being mounted on vehicles, some of which are still on the market. And, you know, that never really played out. I think most of the evidence suggests that the one thing that people really need to do is be aware of these times of year when deer vehicle collisions peak, and to be as cautious as you can possibly be at the times of day when deer are most active, which is dawn and dusk or during the dark of the night. And the problem, of course, now is with the rut on, the breeding season. These deer are running willy-nilly across the landscape, even in broad daylight, and with, on the case or in the part of the bucks, with little regard for their own safety and paying little attention to what's going on around them, which is what makes them so vulnerable to hunting, to archery hunting this time of year. But it also means that deer vehicle collisions are a real problem, and in some cases, it's hard to avoid them. I remember a case with my department chairman back in the 80s, and he was driving at this time of year, saw a buck coming across a big wide open field. And I remember him describing trying to calculate the angle of intersection, you know, where's the deer going to cross the road and where am I going to be? And he's kind of jockeying his speed, but the deer's still going. And it got to the point where he kind of got up there and the deer's getting closer and closer. And for lack of something else to do, he stopped in the road. And the deer kept running and just piled right into the side of the car. It was stopped. So being cautious and being conservative will go a long way. But in some cases, these things are hard to avoid. As far as this horn device, you know, I can see the pulsing probably being better than a steady sound. But the problem is you have such a split second to react if this deer bounds up out of the ditch that, you know, from my standpoint, I'm going to be worried about steering the car through the collision rather than swerving, which is one of the best pieces of advice the safety people pass out.
Don't swerve?
And no, don't swerve. Oh, geez, no. That's, I mean, the best thing you can do to improve your averages is just keep going straight. Brake if you can, but steer the vehicle straight. Hit the deer if you must, but don't swerve, because the real problems for people tend to be when they do swerve either into oncoming traffic, which is the worst, or swerve off the road, hit a tree, flip the car, do something else. So that's where the real safety problems for people come in is in attempting to avoid the accident and making things worse for yourself. Hitting the deer is bad enough, and in the case of this recent fatality in Dane County, just I think on Sunday night or over the weekend, I think there the deer came right through the windshield, which does happen occasionally, and you know that's obviously a result of hitting it and throwing it up through the windshield, and in that case, the notion of swerving or not swerving may not have come into play. But I think on average, you're better off to drive right through the collision.
Interesting.
The statistics are pretty scary. There have been a couple of articles in the paper recently with some data released by State Farm Insurance that places Wisconsin third in the country in terms of probability of a deer car collision. And in our state, it's a 1 in 99 chance for the average driver to hit a deer every year. The highest, I think, was in West Virginia or Virginia at 1 in 57. But even one, to call it 1 in 100 for Wisconsin.
That's,
you know, with people buying the lottery tickets at millions to one odds, 1 in 100, pretty good odds that sooner or later you're going to hit a deer.
Thanks, Scott, for calling. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Scott, and good morning, Larry. They say there are two kinds of drivers in Wisconsin, those who have hit a deer and those that are going to.
That's correct, yes.
But my reason for calling, I had an interesting observation several weeks ago. I was out west of Pittsville chasing the mice out of our hunting shack. And right near there, just a couple of miles west, saw an animal cross the road. And by all observations, it was a fox. I was quite close, except that it was pure black.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if that's common, or I don't believe it was an escapee from a fox farm. There are none in that area. And I wondered if you had seen anything like this or have had any reported.
A black fox or melanistic fox, as it would be called, is pretty unusual, although it does occur, apparently. In fact, we're just working on a book on Wisconsin mammals, and I was reviewing the fox chapter just yesterday, and there was some
fresh
comment.
Fresh in your mind.
Fresh in my mind. There was some comment made about the color phases, the normal color phases of red fox, and the melanistic foxes were mentioned, but unusual, more common in terms of partial melanism to have what's called a cross fox, where the shoulders and back are dark, the rest of the animal's silver, or a silver fox, which is another color variation. Of course, you mentioned the fox farm issue, and Wisconsin has always been one of the leaders nationally with fur farming in terms of fox and mink and so forth, and both of those animals bred in captivity on farms come in a whole variety of unusual color phases. And they do occasionally escape. So given the tremendous distance such an animal could move, the fact that there may not be any farms in the immediate vicinity of where you saw the animal wouldn't entirely rule that out. So one possibility, although probably a little more remote, is that it was an escapee, and the other is that it was a natural melanistic fox, which does happen, but it's very unusual. So it's a good sighting one way or the other, Dave.
Sure is.
I have one other question. Some time back, we had a discussion. I spoke with you on your show, and I had emailed you a couple of photos of a gray fox climbing a tree, and I wondered if you were successful.
I did get those, and it were very good photos of a gray fox climbing a tree. For folks who don't know what we're talking about here, gray fox, another species of fox in the state, and a member of the dog family. Generally, dogs don't climb trees very well, if at all. But a gray fox is a bit of an exception. They're a little more cat-like among the dog family, and they do climb very well. And Dave sent two very nice electronic files for gray fox scrambling up the side of a tree. And we actually pass those on to the folks working on this mammals project as being something they may want to contact you about using. But well, I did get them, and thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Appreciate it. Tom in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Great.
Good. Hey, I wanted to ask you, Scott, if you've ever heard of, it's called QDM, Quality Deer Management.
Yep.
What's kind of your insights on that? What do you think? I mean, is it something that would benefit people if they try to implement it, or what's kind of your opinion on it?
Well, the Quality Deer Management Association is a very big, very well-organized national group now with chapters in Wisconsin, much like you see chapters of other organizations like the Rough Grouse Society or Ducks Unlimited or whatnot. So I think if you check around a bit, especially on the web, Tom, you can find out where there's a local chapter. They have a beautiful magazine, Quality Deer Management, that comes out, and a variety of literature and assistants and staff biologists and so forth who can help you out. And there are some books on the subject as well. Initially, when things first got underway, I think people tended to look at quality deer management. Oh, gee, those are just trophy hunters. You know, they're interested in producing huge bucks. But in fact, while it is a goal to improve the age and sex structure of a herd so that there are bucks that people are really interested in shooting, the real underlying effort of the Quality Deer Management Group is, as they put it, quality deer and quality habitats. And it's an effort to improve deer habitat, and through management and the hunting strategies used on a particular piece of property, to adjust the sex and age structure and the health of the herd so that it is in balance with its environment and there is a good age structure and sex structure for people to hunt. It's often something that's done as a bit of a cooperative. So something, if you have a parcel of property and you can interest your neighbors or they interest you, the larger the parcels that can be amalgamated, so to speak, given the fact that deer move around the landscape, the more success that effort might have. But it has certainly grown in popularity over the years, and I think it's something, if you're interested in deer management, you might want to check into.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Jamie in Green Bay, I believe, is next. Jamie, what's on your mind?
Hi. I would like to call and comment on the man who called in earlier about the rapid horn blowing system.
Yeah.
And I heard either him or somebody else on one of your shows maybe a couple of years ago touting doing that manually. I don't know if this is the same guy who invented a device to do it or not, but I thought, gosh, I'll have to try that because there are lots of deer around our house, and I've been using it, and it is amazing how it really seems to work. I'll see a deer standing by the side of the road ahead of me, and I'll just tap my horn just real quickly, staccato, and that deer will look at me, turn, and run away from the road.
Wow.
That's good.
Yeah.
Anything that works, keep it up.
Yeah. I thought, man, if it really works, that'd be fantastic. So, and it seems to work. I've tried it several times, and each time the deer's turned away, it seems to be able to not get just dazed by the sound and not know where it's coming from. It seems to be able to identify that you're coming towards it and to move away from you.
Huh.
Well, good enough.
Good enough. Thank you very much for calling. Jamie, it's worked for her and it's probably maybe saved her a little bit of money on car repairs. Who knows? Thank you very much. Dave in Reedstown, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks. Scott, I'm wondering if you could imagine what would the deer herd have been the size, say, in the year maybe 1600, because and prior to the invasion of European white people here, And the reason I'm wondering is because I believe that the deer herd is artificially maintained at this absurdly high level for commerce, period. The resorts, chambers of commerce, tourism industry, there's so much money to be made with 500,000 hunters invading from Illinois and such that they keep it this high, and we have to suffer with Lyme disease, car crashes, high insurance rates, crop damage. And so what do you think the herd is? Like in Boundary Waters, I know I go there, and you hardly see a deer, one deer in a whole week.
Yeah. All right. Well, Scott, what do you think?
Well, the deer herd, Dave, has, I think, come and gone in different parts of the state over the years, depending on the influence of human land use and human activity and some other events like the logging era, the era of fires and so forth, and that slash that produced excellent deer habitat for a while. So if you go back far enough to get back before white settlement and the landscape was a little more pristine, there's some speculation that the deer herd was quite high and mm-hmm. more uniformly distributed. Then along came some of the changes I just mentioned, and the herd has flip-flopped a little bit as we entered into the logging era in the turn of the last century, around 1900. Deer were a scarce commodity in the southern part of the state and rather common in the north. And then things began to turn around a bit as the northern forest matured and as our land use began to turn the southern agricultural areas more into a mixed landscape that proved to be very conducive to deer numbers and population growth. And all of a sudden, the higher deer densities were in the southern part of the state more recently, southern and central, and lower in the north. And now we seem to be in a period where deer densities seem to be high pretty much statewide, although there's a great deal of disagreement and contentiousness with people who are not seeing as many deer as they think they should on their property or where they're hunting and take issue with a blanket statement like that, that, gee, there are a lot of deer in the state. But the simple reality is the state deer herd could not sustain the kinds of harvests we've been seeing for the last few years of over, you know, literally 500,000 animals taken. And still a lot of deer out there on the landscape standing mm-hmm. around in the field. So there's obviously a very large herd, but they're not uniformly distributed around the state. There are pockets where there are relatively few deer, and there are pockets where there are tremendous populations. So the bottom line is, Dave, yes, there are a lot of deer right now. I guess I'm – and for a while there was some speculation and some management attention in the 70s and 80s was directed at a very conservative harvest level and building the deer herd for some of the reasons you mentioned. But more recently, probably for at least the last decade – the state has been involved in a what I have to interpret as a very aggressive attempt to get the deer herd back down to the management goals that were set years ago for most of our state's deer management units, to get them back down to that level, which provided adequate hunting opportunity, but also was an attempt to minimize some of the problems that you mentioned. Deer vehicle collisions, crop damage, ecological damage in the fields and forests in which the deer live. And we've had a tough time of that. So mm-hmm. as a result, now we see very complicated regulations dealing with many types of harvest strategies and regulations like earn a buck and herd control units. Most of the state, I think, Larry, correct me, I think it was only 15 or 17 of some 130 deer management units that will be going into next Saturday as what we might consider a normal deer hunting season.
Yeah.
In virtually...
And most of those are under what they call the watch, I think it's
right.
Watch list.
So most of our deer management units are in a case where there's still an aggressive attempt, either with inexpensive or free permits in the case of the chronic wasting disease management units, to get people out there with literally empowered to shoot as many deer as they want. You know, we were talking about it around the office yesterday, thinking about just 20 years ago when four hunters had to get together and hope that they might get lucky and draw a so-called party permit
yeah.
so that they could get an extra deer to split up. And now, I mean, you can literally head into the woods with your pockets festooned with permits, and yet there is still plenty of deer out there. So I guess I'm trying to think back to your original question. Dave, there are a lot of deer right now. pretty much statewide. Their numbers and distribution have flip-flopped a bit over the years. But I think at this point, if there ever was an attempt to manage the deer at an outrageously high level for benefits to tourism or hunting or whatever, I think those days are gone. And the attempt now is to be very aggressive in trying to reduce the deer herd. And how successful that will be will depend on 650,000 orange-clad folks carrying guns a week from Saturday.
And by the way, we should mention that Deer Hunt 2007 will be on TV tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night. It's my impression that I tried to check on this on the DNR website. I think it's on Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Public Television affiliate at 8 and all others at 9. But I'm not sure about that. If you really want to catch Deer Hunt 2007 Thursday night, tomorrow night, check your local TV listings and catch it, because there'll be some interesting segments in there on what's coming up for the deer season and some predictions and information on tagging deer. And if you're a deer hunter, it's a good program to catch.
Dave in Cumberland, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Morning. I was wondering if Scott has any idea on the numbers of moose in northeastern or northwestern Wisconsin.
Number of moose.
I know there was one sighted a couple years ago that was actually videotaped by a muskie guide on Chippewa Flowage named Corey Meyer. I know it's a pretty rare sight. Do you have any idea how many would probably be in Wisconsin?
I think, Dave, the numbers that I've seen, and it's perhaps as much guesswork as anything else, suggests that we're only talking about a dozen or 15 individuals, and they seem to be mostly concentrated in the northeastern counties, Oneida, Vilas Forest, in that area, where they're kind of leaking over from the UP. I think it was 2002, the first documented birth of a moose calf in Wisconsin in many, 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 many years occurred. And again, that was in the northeastern part of the state. But they can cover a lot of ground, but I think we're only dealing with a handful of individual animals at any one time.
Okay.
That'd be kind of neat to get them reintroduced into the state, like kind of like the turkey, although it'd be kind of neat to go driving down a road and seeing a moose once in a while.
Well, it certainly would, but there are some issues. The party line has always been that where you have extremely high deer densities, moose generally don't flourish, and it's a negative relationship with disease considerations. So whether or not moose could get a foothold and hold on to it, given the deer densities we currently have in the Northwoods, is questionable.
And I've seen some bumper stickers in Maine, for example, about watching out for moose. If you run into a moose with a car.
Yeah, if you think talking about car-deer collisions is an issue, wait till we have more moose.
Oh, man. But they are great to see. There's no doubt about that. Eileen in Milton, it's your turn now. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
Well, you know, down here in Milton and Janesville, I see hawks pretty often. I don't know what kind of hawks. I don't know the difference between, well, I know red tail obviously is a red tail, but, and I've never seen more than two together. About a month ago, I was visiting some friends in Whitewater, and all of a sudden my friend said, look at those hawks. And we looked up in the sky, and there must have been initially at least 25 hawks. And I know they weren't turkey buzzards because there's, you know, distinct difference.
Yeah, they were kind of circling around and milling around and generally drifting away.
Yes, and then another group joined them. I swear there had to be like 75 to 100 hawks altogether.
Mm-hmm. That's how they migrate. It's called, what you saw is called a kettle of hawks.
Okay.
Kettle, like pot and kettle in the kitchen. And sometimes there could be 10 or 15. There could be several hundred. And they just get together in a loose group and follow the thermals and mill around and circle, and eventually you'll see they slowly drift off in the direction they're headed.
That's exactly what happened. They were like in a circle, but then after, you know, they kept like going to the west, and it was just incredible to see.
It's a neat thing. It's a fall phenomenon that folks see, and it's a normal pattern of migration for those birds.
It's fun to see, though, Eileen.
Well, I've got my answer. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Nancy in Lake Nabagamon, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I live out in some kind of deep woods, and not too long ago, I was looking out of my window, and I saw a big cat. And I went flailing around for my binoculars, and by the time I got back to the window, I could see that it was what I thought was probably a bobcat, but it seemed big to me. When I looked it up, I read that bobcats are about twice the size of a house cat, and it just seemed bigger. And I can't believe it could have been a lynx, but I was just wondering if there are any reports of lynx in Douglas County in recent years and what the likelihood of me seeing a lynx would have been.
Well, let me take the likelihood issue first. So it was a very slim chance, Nancy.
Slim to none.
slim to none. Okay. I mean, most the odds are just against you.
What did the ears look like?
Well, I knew that I should look for the tufts, and it was just far enough away. And by the time I got focused enough and calmed down enough to really look at the ears, I really couldn't tell.
It's an odds thing, and lynx are a very, very rare occurrence in Wisconsin. At best, a few a year, if any at all, depending on the year. So the odds were certainly against you. At depending on the distance and the type of cover it was in, a bobcat, big male or whatever, could be a pretty sizable looking animal. Compared to a house cat, I think certainly in appearance, more than twice the size of a house cat. And the odds are that's what you saw, but we learned a long time ago in this program to never say never when it comes to wildlife observations. So, when we start talking about the cougar situation again here a little later, you'll be hearing more about the probability issue. But bobcats are far more abundant, far more likely to be seen. And one of the things we'll talk about in a minute is the bobcats' movement down into the southwestern part of the state now.
Can you say something about the size of the home range and how likely
of a bobcat?
Mm-hmm.
Huge.
Bobcat home range. Yeah, it's pretty much
measured in square miles, acres. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's all over the state, or over a good portion of the state.
The distribution is still primarily northern half, but moving into the southwest in terms of distribution, in terms of territory or home range. These animals, and the lynx even more so, can cover tremendous distances, even in a single day. But home range is measured in terms of square miles.
Kelly in Waukesha is next. Hi, Kelly.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I'd just like to report to Scott. I met him. I'm a member of the Wisconsin Woodland Owners, and I've met him at a couple woodland conferences. But I have land in Grant County, and last summer in August, I saw a cougar jump across town road about a quarter mile from where my gate is, down close to a little creek. And I couldn't believe what I saw.
Well,
they're pretty hard to miss.
And it had the real long tail and the really big feet. And also this winter, I do some logging in my woods. I have land out a little way south of the Wisconsin River. And I found, had a friend of mine with me, and we saw some deer legs about, 20, 30 feet up in an oak tree, the DeBones. So I just, I know what I saw.
Well, Kelly, this is something. It's a recurring theme of our discussions of wildlife in Wisconsin, are these cougar or mountain lion sightings. And I spoke to one of the wildlife managers from your area this morning. He called in when he had heard on the tagline this morning that we'd be talking about this again, and offered up some of his thoughts. And I think the thinking over the years has changed from no way, no how to. Then it was, these are all former pets or escaped animals or whatever, to now thinking that although there's still no evidence that I know of that we have a reproducing population, no one's seen any cubs or kittens or whatnot, and we still haven't found a road-killed animal, still haven't had those deer hunters turning any in. But people like you who spend time outdoors and know what you're looking at, there are too many sightings like that to discount. The folks at UW-Stevens Point are, plotting these things and working toward a management plan at some point to incorporate or think about cougars in Wisconsin. So I think there's no question that there are some out there. How many and what their origins are is still open to some debate, but people are seeing them. And we can probably launch into our discussion of the other aspect of cougars in a second here, Larry. But what was brought to my attention, the researchers who are working on cougars in South Dakota, as we start to think about where could these animals in Wisconsin be coming from, there are two interesting things in just the last week or two. One deals with the fact that the researchers in South Dakota, out in the western part of South Dakota, who were putting radios on mountain lions, and I think it was 15 or 16 animals they had radio collared. Well, where did they go? Well, one ended up heading up into Canada, into Manitoba. One ended up in Oklahoma, and I think it was killed by a train. And one that I think was from the same study, it was either last summer or the summer before, was tracked as it moved east all the way across South Dakota and across most of Minnesota, and I think they lost its signal or broke contact with it. It was still headed east and halfway across Minnesota, so it was certainly headed for us. Whether it got here or not, I don't know. But the point being, these animals can travel tremendous distances. So in addition to the former pets or escape theory, there's certainly some that could get here naturally. The other thing was a rebuttal of a paper that came out that caused some fuss for Michigan a year or so ago, where the authors had reported collecting scat, cat scat, and submitting it to DNA analysis. And their conclusion was that most of the scats they had submitted were, in fact, from cougars, and that the analysis suggested there were X number of different cougars. Well, there was just a rebuttal circulated by another group of scientists recently, and I got it by email a couple days ago, that really took that particular study to task and concluded that there was no way that those conclusions were warranted from their assessment of the information. So it's all a big give-and-take situation. But in addition to the sightings, we've also had lots of recent calls about
Screaming. Women screaming in the night.
Whether some of the sounds people were hearing in the night that tend to raise the hairs on the back of your neck could, in fact, be a cougar. So some were sent to us. We talked about this a month ago. Some were sent to us. There was a lot of detective work searching the internet for sounds, and I think Larry's got a couple queued up here that maybe we should listen
yeah,
to.
Yeah, now this could be loud, but this is a cougar. That was a cougar.
Hmm. Well, they make, like many animals, they make a wide range of sounds, but these are apparently some that were selected for their shock value, if nothing.
Let's try this one.
Well, I guess I wouldn't want to hear that while I was sitting around the campfire in the backyard, but
no.
Those are some of the things that we came up with. And if for those folks who have been hearing sounds in the night, if that sounds anything like what you heard, then yes, a possibility that one of these cougar sightings has actually turned into a calling or screaming animal in your neck of the woods. But we also came up with a lot of other speculation. And that included, beyond the cougars, the fact that bobcats are, as I said, moving down into other parts of the state. My wildlife manager colleague reported day before yesterday that a bobcat was caught in a coyote trap, and I think probably released just on the Iowa-Grant County line. And they'd had several other records recently, too. So bobcats can also scream and make a variety of noises.
I wouldn't want to be the one to release the bobcat from the trap.
Yeah, you need to know what you're doing. But another listener emailed me this morning and said, "Say, how come you haven't mentioned rabbits?" And that was a good call. When we were speculating on these things a month ago. If you've ever heard a rabbit, rabbits don't make much noise. But if they're grabbed by a predator, or if you grab one to take it out of a live trap or whatever, they can make the most blood-curdling scream you can imagine. Several of my colleagues discussing this mentioned coons, raccoons, when they're squabbling with each other over a food source or during the mating season, can make some just horrific screams and howls and yowls. Same thing with the owls we've talked about before, and either when the young ones are begging for food earlier in the season or when they're being booted out of the adult's territory in the fall, a young displaced or hungry owl, especially a barred owl, can make some incredible screams. Porcupines were brought up. In terms of me tracking down sounds in the woods, the most bizarre one I ever heard was in Door County, and I thought someone was torturing a puppy or a child. And we finally moved through the woods and said, "Oh, it's coming from that birch tree." And there were a couple of porcupines up in the birch tree making these horrible human-like or puppy-like sounds. So there are lots of sources. And if people liken these things to a person or a woman in particular screaming in the night, I'd also submit that where there might be a handful of cougars and perhaps several thousand bobcats and more raccoons and owls, there are some 5 million people in Wisconsin, give or take a few, and there's not much of Wisconsin that isn't influenced by people. And I can think of several occasions where I've heard people, for whatever reason, yelling or screaming in the night, if for no other reason than to yell and scream. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if some of the things people hear really are people screaming. So there are some of the things. You heard a couple things. There are some of the possibilities. Most of them we'll never identify for sure, but at least you know there are some options out there.
Larry in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Great show, guys. Two things. My wife and I went up to Minocqua on last Friday, and when I started counting deer moving, I counted dead 12 from the time we started counting about north of a little bit of Stevens Point.
Well, we started, my wife and I drove up on Thursday. We drove the same road, and we started counting in about Portage, I think. They were all over the place.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
The other thing is, Scott, that my neighbor spotted a wolf a week ago this last Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick is a hunter, and he would know a wolf. And for what it's worth, Larry, not too far from the Korthmacher farm.
Oh.
So just wanted to let you know that.
Oh, well, that's real close to where I used to live. Thanks, Larry.
Sure.
Appreciate the call. Wow. More callers online here, but I tell you what, I just want to remind you, our guest today is Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question. The number, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison at 263-1890. Ed in Burlington is next, so we go to Ed now. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. I lived in Marinette County for 10 years. Well, I actually lived there about 12 years, but I was coming home. I lived right between Pembine and Niagara on Chapman Road, which was County R, and I seen a cougar cross the road about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I kind of... It just kind of shocked me. I actually was going home from work because I had a terrible toothache that was really bad, and I was coming through a curve, and it was right there crossing the road. Well, we went back to the big anthill on the side, about 12 feet long, that I had walked across, but it had good footprints on. They were huge. But later on that evening, another sighting was reported of it by a farmer that his wife seen it out by their calves. So, I mean, they're around.
They're out there. It would have been nice to have gotten a plaster cast on that footprint.
Mm-hmm.
If you see another one, it'd be nice to do. Thanks, Ed. They're out there. Casey in Port Wing. Hi to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good.
In reference to the woman who called from Lincoln Bagman, it certainly would not be rare to see a bobcat in Peafield or Douglas County. It's loaded up there. You hunt and trap them all the time. And to go out on a Bayfield or Douglas County highway or a country road at 9 o'clock at night and shine for deer, it'd be nothing to see 200-300 deer in an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the hotbed of bobcat populations, and there are a lot of deer up there, too. So no surprise on either count.
Absolutely. Well, I hunt in Bayfield County. There are a lot of deer there.
Are you going to try and reduce the population next week?
Yeah, I will. Oh. Unit 9. Thanks, Casey. Peg in Rice Lake. Hi to you.
Hi there.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, I called last month, and I'm the one who's challenged Scott Craven to tell me that those screams we were hearing were not a bobcat. And he promised he'd find some sounds, and he found some sounds, or somebody did.
Mm-hmm.
And these first two screams you played came pretty darn close.
Well, there you go.
Now, I will say that the one I heard was long ago and up in northern Minnesota, but I've listened with interest to the other callers you've had reporting screams because I know what they're talking about. I heard it, and mm-hmm. I'm not mistaken. The one we heard went on and on, seemed like half an hour, but I'm sure it was maybe 5-10 minutes. My husband and I were playing cards at the table in the living room, 10, 11 o'clock at night, And we just went into a state of paralysis, both of us, looking at each other, thinking we had to get out there and help that woman. And neither one of us moved.
And it's scary.
It was repeated so many times that, you know, you analyzed, and you thought it has to be a woman. But we lived on the edge of the Superior National Forest. We had 40 acres of solid woods and swamp, and there wasn't another house for at least half a mile or longer.
Yep. Could well have been.
Yep. Well, the hearing is believing, I guess, now, and some of those screams would certainly get your attention. So
yeah, they certainly would make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, I would think, if you're out there and actually hear that. Peg, thank you. Thanks very much for calling. Doug in Poplar is on next. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Larry. I was out taking my walk just now, and I had to turn around and come home. Poplar is quite close to Lake Nebagamon.
Yep.
And when that lady called in and said she saw a lynx, I sprinted back to the house. I think I've seen that animal 3 times. And we're not that far from Lake Nebagamon. First time I saw it, I was out on my walk. It was maybe 500 yards from me, so it was really hard to tell. Next time I saw it, it was about 50 yards from me on my driveway. And just last week, a cat walked into my yard. Now, it was really hard for me to believe that in the middle of the day, a cat like that would walk into my yard, but it did. I live out in the woods, and I almost fell over. I looked at it from my bathroom. I started back to the house to get my camera, and wouldn't you know, that big lab that I've got came charging in the yard, chased that cat away. But it had big, long ear tufts. It had a completely black tail. It had really long legs. Its legs had to be as long as my lab's legs. And, of course, the body was a bit smaller than the lab, but it was a big cat. And it had started to leave the yard, and it scared up a rabbit. And it started after the rabbit and stopped, and then the dog came in the yard. But I've been having a fight with my neighbor. He says, you can't have seen a lynx. That's not even possible.
You got to keep that camera handy.
Well, I'd have to take it in the shower with me. I don't know if I want to do that.
Well, it is certainly, excuse me, it is certainly possible, as we told Nancy, I guess it was, from your area. But,
yeah. You
know, it is a odds-wise, it's a long shot, but you called all of the characteristics that would normally be asked about. So
I went, you know, that afternoon right away, I went on the Internet, and I compared bobcats to lynx and the different details. And, I mean, those, when I saw it from a long distance, I suspected it was a lynx, but I didn't want to confirm that to anybody. I didn't even tell anybody.
Right.
But when I saw it in my yard, I mean, it was 20 feet from the window. And I could see those ear tufts were 2-3 inches long.
Well,
and I don't think a bobcat has ear tufts that long.
It should not, but that's something you ought to pass that along to the local DNR wildlife manager for your area, so they can get into that. They can get that into their database of sightings as they try and keep track of that thing, that kind of thing. And what they might do then is, if they don't have a track survey, a winter track survey in that particular area, then they might consider running some back roads when there's snow cover to see if they can verify that. So,
well, you know, the other thing that I found interesting, we have a lot of cottontail rabbits around here. Recently, I've been seeing horseshoes, and they say that's what the lynx like to hunt. And I hadn't seen, you know, any big horseshoe rabbits.
Snowshoes. Snowshoe rabbits.
Snowshoes, I mean. Horseshoes are different.
Horseshoe, snowshoe, what's the difference?
Getting all excited about this lynx thing. And that's what I understand that they like to hunt, so I don't know if one's bringing the other in or what. But
well, you'd expect, as we're on the upswing in the grouse cycle, hares are usually right in there as well. They're both northern species that tend to exhibit that cyclic population growth. So you'd expect to be seeing more snowshoe hares right now, and probably more next year, and more for a year or two in the future. And then they'll begin to tail off again. And they are a favored prey of lynx. So who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Keep your camera ready, though. Even in the get an underwater camera for the shower. All right.
Or get yourself a couple of trail cameras and put them up around the house.
Trail cameras would be a good idea. Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it. Chris and Racine, on to you. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I am calling because I don't know what to do, if anything. There's a guy who has a wolf and walks him around downtown were seen. And there are enough people who would know, who know that it's a wolf. We talked to the guy one day, and he said it's an Alaskan dog, but it's big. I asked him if I could pet him, and he said yes. And the dog put his jaws on my arm, and luckily I had a coat on, so he didn't hurt me. But, you know, he had a strong, and it wasn't real aggressive. He seems well cared for. He's had him since he was a pup. And I don't know if, you know, it seems like a tragedy waiting to happen. And I, for the guy, I don't know if it's status or security or power or what, but it's a wolf. And, you know, I'm surprised that the police haven't done something, but, you know, maybe it's okay. I just don't know what to think.
Probably a wolf hybrid.
Well, it's more likely a wolf-dog hybrid, and that's been a kind of a contentious issue for a long time when it came to wolf recovery, but it seems to have fizzled out a little bit in recent years. But, you know, not seeing the animal or taking the fellow's comment at face value that it's an Alaskan breed or whatnot, I don't know what you saw, but I doubt what you saw was a full-blooded wolf. So
it's probably a hybrid.
It's probably a hybrid. It's probably a legal issue. And, you know, in terms of, it'd be one thing to be sympathetic about the animal, but on the other hand, if it's being well cared for, you could offer up that argument for any type of domestic dog or pet. Mm-hmm. And if it's a hazard issue that concerns you, then that's no more so a concern than with some of the other mm-hmm. dog breeds that we hear so much about in the news. So I'm not altogether sure there's much you can do about this,
no.
Or that there's anything illegal going on.
There may be,
or even unethical.
I don't think there's any state ordinances on it, but there could be some local ordinances. So you may want to check locally at Racine there, Chris. But otherwise, there's not much that can be done. But just to let people know who may own hybrids or may own dogs that are aggressive and bite people, insurance companies are taking a very dim view of that anymore. And so homeowners insurance and things like that are very hard to get or can be eliminated if you have a dog or a hybrid or another animal like it that would create a problem or bite somebody. That's for sure. Thanks, Chris. Good luck. Tom in Mount Hope, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom.
Hi there, Larry and Scott. A lot of talk about cats today.
Yeah.
But my question, well, on a note, I've heard two reports. I live in southwest Wisconsin, and two reports from different farmers of seeing bobcats this summer.
Mm-hmm.
One a couple weeks ago, so I found that of interest that you said there is actually a population moving into southwest Wisconsin. But my question for you is, cougars, were they once established? I mean, was this once their range?
Sure.
In southwest Wisconsin?
Absolutely. They were a native species in the state, and I think the last record was somewhere around the 1880s or whatnot when they were presumably extirpated. But, yes, they were here as a native species.
Well, that brings my story. My father was an avid fox hunter. They used to hunt back, I'm not sure, I would say late 40s, early 50s when there was a bounty on fox. And they would head hounds, and they run and run and run. Excuse me. He always told the story that they lost the dogs for practically a whole day. When they found them, they had a cougar treed up a hay elevator. And when they got there, this cougar jumped, him and his brother, broad daylight, jumped off the top of this 20-foot hay elevator, and away the dogs go again, and lost them again. But so that was in the 30s and 40s, you know,
mm-hmm.
that they saw one then. And I was wondering if that would be a carryover, the same thing of one coming east from out west, or a carryover from a population that was here.
Well, I suppose it could be either, but I think this general agreement that they pretty much disappeared from the state well before that as a viable remnant population, and if you know, if they're capable of trucking on in here from South Dakota now, they certainly were then, and there were probably remnant populations closer to Wisconsin in those years than western South Dakota at this point. So
yeah,
no telling, but
nope.
We'll just add it to the list of the cougar records that keep mounting up.
Thanks, Tom. Dick in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Sure. Hi, Scott. Larry, a couple of quick moose observations.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they definitely are in northeast Wisconsin, several dozen miles
east of Eagle River. There are recent moose sightings, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I had occasion to be on a western hunt, and our hunting party heard about another party where a hunter had mistaken a moose for an elk. Later, we heard from all kinds of people that if it's black, be exceedingly careful. Odds are it's a moose and not a swamp buck. So just passing that word of caution along to all the fellow people wearing orange next Saturday.
That's good advice for a variety of reasons. It's good advice to protect our growing and expanding elk population over near Clam Lake in the northwestern part of the state, and to protect any of those few moose that are still straggling around. So, yeah. or domestic stock or whatever else. In other words, go back to that basic rule of firearms. Don't shoot unless you're sure of your target.
And thanks a lot for calling, Dick. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. We're talking the world of wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Scott, I mentioned feral pigs on the show, and they're getting to be a problem in some areas of Wisconsin, and the DNR wants us to take action.
Well, yes, and the fact that there are some around, regardless of their source, they could become a much worse problem if action isn't taken. I think that's why the DNR is being aggressive in this case. Pigs of any kind in the wild are like wild bulldozers. They can really tear up the environment. So the bottom line is that the DNR once again is asking hunters to, whenever the opportunity presents itself, if they get a chance to shoot feral pigs, to do so. And there is a feral pig fact sheet on the DNR website you can click on and link to and find out where they are and the regulations, which are virtually kind of a free-for-all. If there's no opportunity to actually shoot said pig, then they would at least appreciate a report of the sighting so they can track where these animals are being seen. And then if you are lucky enough or have the opportunity to shoot one, they're asking that those pigs be presented at a DNR office so they can take some samples. You're welcome to the pig, but they need some blood and perhaps tissue samples to track some of the, among other things, the diseases that these animals can be involved in spreading. So bottom line is, if you get a chance to harvest a feral pig,
you
should do so.
Okay. Dennis in O'Connell is on next. Dennis, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Great program. Wish Scott would be on a little bit more often. But my question is, I have basically three is bears. I live up here in O'Connell, and a couple of years ago, my dog went nuts at night out in the backyard and go out there and hear the bear and her two cubs. Now I see in the paper here, three blocks down from me the other night, there was another bear sighted. I drive truck up here in northeastern Wisconsin, and in the last year, I see four of them hit on the highways.
Mm-hmm.
One up by Amberg 3 days before Christmas.
Oh, man.
And he was 500 and some pounds, I think they said. But that's another part of my question, too, is I noticed the bears are getting bigger and bigger. You know, when I was a kid, they were 200-300 pounds of the big pig.
Bear.
But now you're seeing 500-600-pound bears. And then the last question that I'll just take the rest, listen off the air, but is right now for a kill permit is like 7-year waiting period. They plan on ever bringing that up a little bit sooner?
Okay.
Well, let's see. So I think I'll go in reverse order. There is a 6 or 7 year wait to obtain a kill permit. I think there were something like 60,000 applicants last year, and it does take a while. But that just is a reflection of the. Although there are, relatively speaking, it seems like a lot of bears, the population estimate I think is only around 13,000, something like that, give or take 1,000. And we have one of our researchers in the wildlife program and his PhD student are working on that population study that we've talked about on the program,
yeah,
where they put out bacon baits all over the state last year laced with tetracycline, and that's absorbed into the bear's bones. And then when a hunter harvests the bear, they turn in a rib and they can – anyway, they're coming up with what will probably be the – hopefully be the best or most accurate population estimate we've had. And whether that will prove or demonstrate that there's more or less bears remains to be seen. But 13,000 bears is not relative to 1.7 million deer or 5 million people.
Yeah.
Is not a lot of animals, but they're big and conspicuous, and people stand up and take notice when you see a bear as opposed to a chipmunk. So the perception is that there are a lot of them out there, but relatively speaking, they're not that abundant. They do seem to be extending their range south a little bit, and the population may still be growing, so that may have something to do with it. I think in terms of the size of the individuals, I think we've probably already always had 500 or 600 pound bears around.
I was trying to remember the state record. It's 800?
Yeah, something like that. It's huge. But I don't think there's any evidence that the bears have become any healthier, fatter, or what have you, although there are certainly some large bears taken. But
yeah,
most don't approximate that, but that size.
So. All right. Thanks, Dennis. Thanks for calling. And Sarah, a veterinarian from Arcadia, is online. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great,
enjoy
thanks
your
for
show.
Thank you.
I had this summer was called out to a call in Trempealeau County. A mini horse had been killed. It was very upsetting. They came out and the mini horse had been basically chewed up around the neck area and was dead. And they took a paw print of the paws, you know, the tracks that were in the area, and it was as wide as maybe an eighth of an inch smaller than a dollar bill. And I listen all the time on
that'd
the road.
Be 6 inches.
Yes, it's big. And they never, you know, we've never seen it again, any more additional tracks. But, you know, that was really shocking that something that big would be in the area.
Well, 6 inches.
That's pretty big even for a wolf or a cougar, I think. That's getting right up there, but hopefully somebody preserved that.
Did they preserve that, do you know?
We took a picture of it, but as far as I know, the DNR didn't come out, or as what I had heard last, they hadn't been out, but I haven't heard from the farm since. But I took a picture. I have a picture.
Well, I'm not sure what killed the horse, and I'm not sure who investigated it, but the group or the agency in Wisconsin that handles most of those kinds of things now is not the DNR. It's USDA's Wildlife Services offices. There's one in Sun Prairie, one in Rhinelander, and one in Waupun, and they have biologists scattered around the state. But they, like the DNR or really anybody else, have access to a variety of manuals and resources that allow photo comparison of any particular predation event to predation event by events by different kinds of animals. In other words, cats kill differently than dogs, weasels kill differently than dogs and cats, and feral dogs or wild dogs are the messiest of all. But there are some folks around the country who are pretty good at looking at a carcass or the tooth marks or where the damage occurs on the animal and coming up with a pretty good approximation or estimation of what actually killed it. Now, it may be too late for all of that this time around, but if
she still has the photo, though.
You know, yes, quite a few photos of
well,
the animal.
You know, I think that those could be submitted to the Wildlife Services folks, and if there aren't folks in Wisconsin who have you know, predation is not a huge issue here in this state, but as you get down into Texas or some of the western states, it is a big issue, and I'm sure there are folks who would be willing to look at those photographs and offer up their opinion of what happened.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting.
You could you can send them to me, you can send them here to the station, whatever you want to do, but I think there are folks who can have a look at those and give you an estimate, an approximation of what happened.
Yeah, send them to me here at Wisconsin Public Radio. The address is 821 University Avenue.
Okay.
And Madison 53706, and I'll forward it on to Scott.
Okay, thank you. I will do that.
Okay. All right, thanks, Sarah. Appreciate it very much. And I'm sure the folks will be interested in seeing those. Ryan in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Ryan.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm calling regarding, you guys had previously mentioned the Clam Lake elk herd.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been, I hunt near that area, and I was curious, so my question is kind of two-part. One, I had heard that the majority of the firstborns were killed off by either bear or wolf. can you either confirm or deny? I was just kind of curious.
Well, they have certainly had some mortality of the calves to both bears and wolves, and there's also been a roadkill issue. There are a number of things that have been mortality factors on those animals, both adults and calves, that are probably a little higher than maybe they had hoped or anticipated. So the herd growth has perhaps not has been ra- not has. Let me try
it's
that
not
again.
Been as rapid.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Hasn't been as rapid as they might have hoped or expected because of some of these mortality factors, and predation on the calves has been one of those. So
okay.
You're right.
Next question is, in the state of Wisconsin, how imminent does injury or death have to be to an individual for, let's say, a wolf, bear, or mountain lion attack in order for you to shoot the animal without any repercussion?
I don't think I can answer that question, and I'm not sure that that's the perception of danger is
yep.
going to vary from person to person, and I don't necessarily think that there's anything in statute that says, well, they have to have at least three teeth embedded in your left leg before you can take action. So I don't know how to respond to that. I think that that's going to have to be an individual perception of danger and then perhaps have to deal with the consequences. But I know there are probably some folks listening who could maybe call in and offer what a warden's or a legal interpretation of that may be. In other words, when does taking action become justifiable self-defense, I guess is the question.
Correct. And correct. That is exactly the question.
I don't know how that's actually codified into law.
I don't know.
I've had actually wolves, bears, and mountain lions within 10 feet
mm-hmm.
and a pistol drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just curious, do I have to let them attack me? Or, you know what I mean? I fire in the air, and the last time the boar didn't move, meaning he wasn't scared of me.
Mm-hmm.
That was a 500-pound black bear. So I was just kind of curious.
Well, I think the common sense or logical hope and approach here would be that people would take steps to escape the situation, frighten off the animal, do the very things that you've done. But if those actions fail, you know, at that point, if you really feel that your life is in imminent danger, then, you know, I think everybody has to make the call personally. I think we need to see how the law reads on that, if there even is relevant law that
yeah.
assesses. I don't know how you could quantify the relative threat so that it would be meaningful in court. So the question is, if you take defensive action and shoot whatever it is, a bear, a mountain lion, a wolf, anything else, and all of a sudden end up in court, okay, you're being prosecuted for shooting said animal, I think then it becomes a matter of the interpretation not only of your relative risk, but the interpretation of the judge and jury. So I'm not sure that can be actually quantified.
Well, we may maybe look into that a little further, maybe talk to some folks at the DNR.
We can check on that for the next program. But
yeah, it'd be worth looking into.
You know, most folks are not going to put their life on the line
in
that kind of a situation.
No. Thanks, Ryan. We'll look into that, and hopefully we'll have something for you at the next program. And Bill in Washera County, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
Got a woodpecker question.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're switching gears here a little bit from charismatic vertebrates to birds. But
quite all right.
Good, good. In the area I live in a very wooded part of southern Washera County, and a lot of undisturbed forest, primarily hardwood oaks and white pine. I am never, ever, and I'm out a lot, seeing any red-headed woodpeckers anymore. In
mm-hmm.
fact, we've got highly-headed woodpeckers here like robins, practically, and I'm exaggerating a little bit. But I see highly-headed woodpeckers. I hear them all the time. Good population of downy. Hairy and red-belly, not quite as much. I do put suet out this time of year in the cold months, and that, of course, attracts them. But it's probably been over a year since I've seen any red-headed woodpeckers. I might have heard one or two, although sometimes when I can't see them, my identification by sound alone isn't 100%. Just wondered, any comments or reflections on that?
It's a common observation. Red-headed woodpeckers are on the decline.
Yep.
They've become far less common than they were and are on the decline. So you're seeing the other species, and having pileateds around is great. They're a spectacular woodpecker, but redheads are beautiful, and they are on the decline. It's habitat issues and a variety of other things. If you go to a website called ebird.org, and you can get on to the North American bird data, and I think you can navigate your way to some charts and data that would suggest the rate of decline and where it's been most prevalent. So you can satisfy your curiosity that way. But they are clearly less common than they once were in southern Wisconsin.
Much less, much less. We did have, I was amazed to see one. We saw one this year. That was a great sight to see. Frank in Ferryville, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Hello, good afternoon. I listened with interest to your comments about wild hogs or feral pigs or whatever we might call them. And we have some of those here in southwestern Wisconsin. And Scott said DNR is encouraging that they be shot off, if that's possible. But I'm looking at the 2007 small game regulations, and it says that you have to have a small game license to do that. Now, we're going to have, what, 650,000 or so hunters going into the woods during deer season. A significant number of those people will not have small game licenses, and they won't be able to shoot one should they see it. That seems to me to be a little bit contradictory.
Well, I agree, and I'm just trying to think of the there was a report on this issue in the last DNR news update that came out last Thursday that talked about that, and I'm pretty sure from a landowner's perspective, you need no license at all. And I think that small game, I think you're right on the small game license situation. I would, you know, I don't know what the overlap is, but certainly those people hunting with a sports license or a patron's license are covered either way. And I would guess that a significant number of the deer hunters will have the small game license. But I agree, that's kind of an inconsistency if the attempt is to really get them out of there at all costs. So I'd have to refer back to that newsletter or go to that fact sheet on feral pigs on the DNR website that I mentioned and verify that. Mm-hmm. But if your observation is correct, and I have a feeling it is, it does seem a bit inconsistent.
Yeah, it sure does. Thanks, Frank, for calling and drawing that to everybody's attention. So if you're a deer hunter and you don't have a small game license and you're not the landowner, you need to be careful. Ben in Rhinelander, hello.
Hello, Scott, Larry. You gentlemen have been talking a lot about animal movement, a lot of animals like moose coming, ranging more south, lynx, bobcat, and even the cougar coming from the west. I'm up here in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, and in the DNR flyer, a little leaflet that they have for Pacific animals, particularly the gray fox, they state that they're basically in the lower one-third of the state. I've been seeing a lot of them up here in Rhinelander, Wisconsin.
The distributions of animals are kind of like watching the weather maps on the nightly news, where if you're curious about what's happening to your son or daughter who lives in North Carolina, and gee, you look at the weather map and it's raining, supposed to be raining like crazy, and you call them up, it's, oh no, it's beautiful here. Those distribution efforts are sometimes based on old information. And they sometimes don't take into account the mobility of the animals and some changes over time. If you look, considering Rhinelander, we have a field research station just up the road from you on Highway 47 at Kemp. And the party line has been, for example, with another animal, the flying squirrel, that southern flying squirrels were, gee, they're only in the southern part of the state. But over the last few years, we've been catching scads of southern flying squirrels right there at Kemp Station. And in fact, southern flying squirrels now occur all the way to Lake Superior. So some of these distributions change over time, and sometimes it takes the information a little while to catch up with that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling, Ben. Russ and Amory, your turn. Hi, Russ.
Hello. Thanks for the program. I'm really enjoying it. The first question I had was, you've talked a lot about gathering data, and I could probably send data on a constant stream. What data is useful about, you know, what animals I see? How do I collect it? Do you want to plaster cast of every footprint?
No, not at all. But there are many ways to contribute. There are a lot of so-called citizen science initiatives and projects around the state, and you can find out some of these from the DNR website. I think there's a citizen science link on there. There are lots of opportunities as a volunteer data collector. The Frog and Toad Survey, the Winter Carnivore Track Survey. There are things like that that you can contribute to, or if it's just a matter of what you're seeing at any given time, the Wisconsin Nature Mapper program, which is administered by the Beaver Creek Nature Preserve up near Eau Claire. It's wisnatmap.org, wisnatmap.org. If you get involved in that, you can enter all of the information you're collecting by observations into that database, and all of that is very helpful in us figuring out, you know, what's where at any given time. So lots of opportunities, and if you like the thought of, you know, contributing and having your outdoor activity contributing to our understanding, then there are lots of ways to do it.
Yep. Thank you very much for calling. And Roland in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Roland.
Hi, good morning. I read an article in Audubon Magazine two or three years ago about these cell phone towers that are erected in the wild with the support cables. And apparently in foul weather, especially when it's foggy and songbirds are migrating in the evening, they start circling around these the lights on these towers and strike these cable. And they find hundreds of them at times after in the morning. And I have to think that there should be more, and I don't see anything about that in the general news where the laws should be changed and require these four-footed towers that don't require these cable supports to protect the songbirds. We feed birds all the time, and we used to see just hundreds of them coming daily. And
not so much anymore. Well, Scott, what do you think?
Well, tower mortality is a big issue. It has been for a long time.
We've done some research on this.
We have a master's student in the wildlife program right now working on it. She's collecting songbirds at some local towers, and she's had some very impressive collections just in this season on nights when migration is occurring and weather conditions are such that the birds are disoriented or not able to see or avoid those cables, that it can be a considerable source of mortality. And as more towers go up, it gets worse. But the research hopefully will point toward modifications and things that can be done to mitigate that loss. But Roland's comment is well taken. Mortality at wind farms to bats and birds, mortality with various communications and television radio towers has been known for a long time. You know, these are all things that people demand, however, and we sometimes have to there's some trade-offs involved.
Yeah, there are. And Scott, we've got a trade-off here too, because
we're out of time.
We're running out of time here. Thanks so much for being with us today, and get those bird feeders out and get them going.
Yep, it's time to get your bird feeders out and operational, and it's time to animal-proof your house for the winter before it's too late. Get out there and protect those shrubs and your house.
Scott Craven, University of Wisconsin Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today as we talk the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. And, of course, he will come back. He always comes back on the first Wednesday of the month. I'm sure you'll have some stories of deer hunting and other issues when he returns in December. And so we'll look forward to that visit. Coming up tomorrow at 11, excuse me, we'll be talking home renovation and repair issues. And our guests, a couple guys who can become regulars on the show, Ken Adams of Madison and John Freiberger of Fitchburg, our guests tomorrow at 11. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.